listeners, welcome back to Carry the One Radio. I'm Sydney, and I'm here to bring you the third episode in the Black Excellence in STEM series, a collaboration with Black Excellence in STEM, or BSTEM, here at UCSF. BSTEM is a registered campus organization whose main focus is to provide support, resources, and community for Black students and future Black doctors of UCSF. Today, I'm sharing with you an interview I did with Dr. Katera Wilder. She is an assistant professor here who studies lung epithelial cells, which are the cells on the surface of the lung. These cells form a physical protective barrier on the lungs, but Dr. Wilder investigates another one of their many roles, communicating with the immune system. Stay tuned to hear all about it. Hello, everyone. This is a special episode with just Sydney Williams on the mic today. And I am graced with the presence of a phenomenal faculty, Dr. Katera Wilder. Do you mind giving us a formal introduction of who you are and what you do here at UCSF?
Yes. So I'm Katera Wilder. I am an assistant professor here at UCSF. I joined the faculty in June. And I have come from a few institutes, namely UCLA and Georgia Tech, and I'm really interested in a variety of things, but namely trying to understand how lung epithelial cells control immune responses. And so I'm excited to be here to discuss that and other things as well.
We're excited to have you for our series for Black History Month. Can you tell us a little bit about your research? What is the topic? I know you talked a little bit about the topic so far, but can you give us a little bit more information on what it is that you're working on? And I believe you're one of our newest computational faculty.
Probably. I don't know. But I could tell you a little bit about what I do. So yeah, there is some mathematical modeling in the work. And that's something that I picked up as a postdoc at UCLA and Alex Hoffman's lab. And so I was really interested as an engineer. I was really interested in trying to make sure that I was doing things like in a quantitative way, because a lot of the research I had as an undergrad was, or not a, as an undergrad and a grad student, was more kind of on the bio side, even though I was, again, in a bioengineering department. And so I am really interested in understanding how, again, epithelial cells, how they respond during respiratory illnesses, and namely how they protect themselves and the type of immune responses that they, immune defense mechanisms that they employ. And kind of the analogy that I usually like to use is if an intruder comes into your house, you have to determine what type of weapon to pick up, if any weapon. Should it be something that's more aggressive, like a gun, or something that's like a knife, or should you just pick up like a bread because it's a friend and you just want to feed them? So like, I'm really interested in how epithelial cells kind of make that decision on like what type of immune defense mechanisms they employ, specifically because if you overreact or if these cells overreact, it could cause damage to your body. And so I'm really interested in like, when does that decision become harmful to your body and to self? And are there ways that we can predict that? And so with the mathematical modeling, it's like, how can we use quantitative and computational tools to understand, like in early stages of disease, will you have this adverse and very severe immune response? And then again, can we like track it out at an early stage so that we can maybe tailor therapies to address it?
Are you working with a specific biomarker when you're talking about these epithelial cells, or how are you making these predictions with your mathematical models?
Yeah, so I study interferons. They're these molecules or cytokines that are induced in these epithelial cells during, again, these early stages of infections. And so they were, during COVID, a lot of people began to look at them even more because some of them were upregulated in people, or actually they were misregulated, whether it was up or down, in patients with severe COVID responses. And so I'm interested in their dynamics at the early stages.
In these interferons and biomarkers that you're using, do you find that there's patterns depending on the people's demographic or their lifestyle, or is it more so universal when you're talking about an immune response to everyone?
the work that I've done thus far is very fundamental, and so I haven't looked at patient-specific responses. I do know just in general, though, that women tend to have more hyperactivation of their immune responses, which is why there are women who have like autoimmune diseases that you might see more common in women than like in men. But I haven't done any work that would look at like race or ethnicity and how that plays a part in terms of responses and the severity of response. So other people may have, but that's definitely a good question that maybe I could employ in some of my future research.
So let's pivot a little bit to personally, how do we get to this topic? I know a lot of people get nervous about finding their niche when it comes to science. How did you find yours?
Part of it was just serendipity. Like some things I think, as much as we think we're in control of our lives, like a lot of things is just random and it's just chance and it's the people who you surround yourself with and the environments that you put yourself in that kind of bring about opportunities. And so at least that's how I view the, at least the topics that I work on now. So I guess going back to like high school or just even earlier than high school, my mom, she is a chemical engineer. So I think having her as a role model was very instrumental in at least me picking STEM as a field of study. And again, she was chemical engineer. And so I at least knew like generally what chemical engineering was, but I think biomedical engineer really stuck to me because of the health aspect. And I really liked the fact that, you know, it felt like there was like a broader reach, at least in my mind, of like this interplay between health and medicine and biology. And so as I was trying to understand like what actually does biomedical engineering mean, like in undergrad, I happen upon undergrad research, which even that was like random. I think I was in a class and like they had people come in that talked about their summer research experiences, and even the professor was like harping on like these different research opportunities. And so I was able to get involved in McNair Scholars Program.
Oh, cool. I did too.
And so that was definitely like, I don't see that program as much at the, like at UCLA, I don't know if they had one, at least I didn't see, and then even here, but at least for me, that was like pivotal in me getting involved in research. And so during that time, again, I just felt like I was surrounded by people who were like pushing, like, you should get a PhD. And again, I just got involved in different aspects. And so I feel like for grad school and as a postdoc, I feel like the topics weren't why I joined labs. It was more so for the people. So I joined the lab of Manu Platt when I was a grad student at Georgia Tech, because I had worked with him previously in a summer research opportunity at MIT, and we just meshed well together. And I think he was just an advocate for me as like a young scientist, and I just really think that we just, again, partnered well. And so again, I being in his lab, I ended up studying proteases and looking at ECM remodeling. And again, I think that I was introduced also to systems biology, which is a field that I'm currently involved in. And so again, it was more so like I want to be with this person, and now I'm in this environment where I am exposed to like what this actually looks like. And then leaving that lab, I wanted to get more involved in systems biology. And like I mentioned earlier, like the quantitative aspects of engineering. And so that's why I went to Alex Hoffman's lab at UCLA. And I didn't care as much about the topic. It was more about the tools. But then once I got there, he was the one who was like, we have these different projects. There's these projects on interferons. And I dived into it. And then that's when I realized like, oh, this is actually like interesting. Not only am I interested in the tools, but I'm actually interested in the topic. And so as a grad, as a faculty, I've been trying to merge the two of looking at remodeling of tissue, as well as looking at these interferons and as biomarkers using systems biology approaches. And again, I that definitely wasn't like starting off, I was like, this is exactly what I want to do. This is the area that I care about or I'm passionate about. I know some people, they're like, they may have a family member that's affected by some tragedy, and then that kind of trajectory of why they end up doing. But really, it was just like, I want to work with these people. These are the opportunities.
That's cool. I feel like a lot of people have the mentality that they have to go into graduate school with a passion or passion project. And that's not necessarily the case. And you can be successful however you choose your project. So I appreciate you sharing that. Mm-hmm. And for those who aren't familiar, can you explain a little bit what systems biology means?
Yeah, so systems biology is a way to look at a problem using like a, I know I hate to say systems, but using like a broader like systems approach. And so a lot of, when I hear systems biology, I'm assuming that the people are using not just experimental tools, but also mathematical modeling. And it's this like iterative process where you, again, are looking at something in a complex system. And because it's complex, you do have to use additional mathematical tools to try to answer some of the complexities of the network. And so it's this iterative process where you have some experiments, you might have a question, and then you go to your mathematical models, and then you run simulations, and you see like, what does the model predict? And then based on that prediction, then you can go and test that hypothesis using experiments. And then you might find something new or interesting that you would then go and take it back to your model and like tweak your model. And so it's this back and forth process, again, usually for more like complex systems to tease apart the intricacies of it.
And going through your graduate school experience, can you talk a little bit about what it was like to explore science, some of the interactions you might have had, especially of a woman of your identity? What has that been like for you in going through higher education?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was actually talking to a friend about this the other day of like what, I mean, because STEM traditionally does not have many people of color, let alone like Black women. I think I was definitely lucky being in Manu Platt's lab. He's a Black man, and I think he is a strong proponent of trying to increase the number of minorities in higher education. And so I feel like my experience was more of like an HBCU experiment or experience in a white space, mm-hmm. because his lab was very diverse and he had a number of Black women specifically in his lab.
Yeah.
But even with that, because again, I was at Georgia Tech, which again, it's not an HBCU, it's very white. Mm-hmm. But again, in that lab specifically, I was surrounded by a number of Black women. There was a Black woman who was a postdoc at the time. Her name was Christy Porter. She was instrumental for me as just seeing someone who was like slightly above me in terms of like her career trajectory, mm-hmm. that could just advise about like life. And then I also had peers, Ivana Parker. She's now a professor at University of Florida. And we were able to just like discuss again some of these topics of like, what is this like to be like a Black woman doing this thing called research? But we also, even given that, there were definitely some instances where it was like, dang, like I'm a Black person in a white space. And I think that came about at different times during the process where, you know, there was a grad student in the program who question if we were given favoritism because of the fact that we were Black and Manu was also Black, and was mm-hmm. he like playing favorites because of that, which was not true, and just throwing us under the bus and basically like spreading lies to other people in the program and us having to basically defend ourselves, which is like, if anything, I feel like he was harder on us because he wanted to push us, because he's like, you are a Black woman in right. this field, and so like you can't just half-ass this. And then even with like quals, and I know quals is different depending on programs, but mm-hmm. we had an oral qual, and I think there was all white men on my committee, and you know, so no women and no people of color. Mm-hmm. And so what does that look like when you have all white men like looking at you, like answer these questions, and whether they had bias? I didn't pass the first time, right, in quals, and we were talking off camera or offline before this about failure. I didn't pass quals the first time. Mm-hmm. I passed the second time, but even that was like a like dang, like again, did they have bias when they saw me? Because I probably didn't answer all the questions the way that they wanted, and I probably wasn't elegant in terms of how I discussed the problems that they were asking. And so again, there's definitely things that popped up, even though I felt like I was in a protected space, where it was like, my color does impact my science and like my career.
And how important was it for you to find or interact with Black mentors? I think one thing that's very difficult for grad students, especially Black grad students, is finding a Black mentor mm-hmm. in higher education. Mm-hmm. How important do you feel that that is in finding a mentor that, you know, identifies with you?
Yeah, I definitely think it's important. Like, there's some things that you just can't. Like, I do value allies, and so I think even if you can't find a Black mentor, there's definitely people who may not identify the same as you in terms of race or ethnicity or gender that can still be advocates for you. But I do think that there is something when you see someone who looks exactly like you in a place of a higher position. And so for me, I think, again, there was benefits of being at Georgia Tech. There were, even though it's still majority white, there was definitely more Black people and other people of color at Georgia Tech because of where it is in Atlanta and just the history of them trying to invest in having Black faculty.
Right.
And so at the time, Gilda Barabino, she was like the assistant chair. And so I just remember, again, bringing back quals, how I didn't pass quals the first time. I remember like going and talking to her about it and just having someone to say like, it's okay. Like you are not, like your identity is not in whether you passed or failed and like you are capable was so instrumental. And again, I had Manu who again was like, I'm going to back for you behind the scenes. And just again, like someone who, and besides like the science, someone who I could relate to, like with cultural things where mm-hmm. like we could talk about, you know, just TV shows or like music right. or just like personal experiences growing up that just made you feel like comfortable, like, okay, like I belong in this space.
Right. Because there's life going on mm-hmm. along and adjacent to the science.
Exactly. So. Which is so important.
Absolutely. And so what brought you here to UCSF? And how's your experience been?
Yeah, it's been good. It's definitely not something that I would have predicted. Again, talking about like how serendipity and just how things happen. If you would have asked me in grad school if I would have been at UCSF, I wouldn't have said, oh, yes, definitely.
Right.
But I'm so happy that I'm here right now. What brought me here was I was applying widely. And again, mentors are so important. So Manu reached out to me and said, you're on the market. Like there's this opportunity. Maybe you should apply. And I did. And I knew some of the people, some of the faculty here. And I also think that helped with picturing myself and feeling like there was like some support here. Once I started interviewing, I think it was very clear that this is such a supportive environment. They actually want you to succeed and that they set you up for at least my experience in my department, which is bioengineering and therapeutic sciences. They are like setting you up for success. Mm-hmm. And so it just felt like an opportunity that I could not pass up. And so I think being here, like what I saw during the interview process has just continued to bore out. And I feel like I've had mentors that, again, I feel like they care about me, just not my science, but like me as a person, and are just always like, are you okay? Checking in. So it's been a really good experience.
Happy to have you here. And for a lot of us who are listening who may not be a part of BSTEM, we have also had the pleasure to have you at our general meetings and involve you in our processes, which we're very grateful for. I think you and I have talked in previous conversations about mentorship and you wanting to mentor students now that you're on the other side of as being a faculty. What's kind of your mentorship philosophy as you come to UCSF and get to experience some of the Black students that you do? Mm.
I know I'm like a philosophy. That sounds so like, I can tell you what I do. I don't know if I've like.
That's okay.
Boiled it down to like a one sentence philosophy, but.
That's okay.
I like to think, one, I just really enjoy mentoring. I care about people, I think in general, and also I've had so many mentors in my life, like I've mentioned, and I think I want to be that person that other people were for me. And so in terms of like how I see mentoring, I just want to use my platform in any way that I can. Again, like I think I care about just people. And so even mentoring, you know, I know some people are like, you should stay along a certain career path or whether that's like academia or industry, but honestly, I just want people to be like the best versions of themselves. And I think, again, going back to like failure, a lot of people put their like identity and like success in STEM or success in research. And so I just want to make sure that people, like, when I'm around them and when they leave me or the space, that they are prepared to take on the world and whatever challenges that they come across. So just trying to break down barriers so that they can become that like optimal version of themselves.
That's cool. We are very excited to be mentored by you and get as much as we can in your wisdom. What are some of your thoughts on PhD training currently? How do you feel like it should be changed, having gone through it and now experiencing it on the other side? How do you feel like PhD training should evolve?
That's another interesting question. How should it evolve? I mean, I know what I've seen. I don't know if I've thought deeply enough to give you like a, this is exactly what should happen. I do think that, I know that some schools and institutes are getting rid of like GRE scores and even like how they are like different exams or even testing. I think the School of Pharmacy got away with some of their like grading systems in terms of like a graded scale for their exams. And I think it makes sense to me. I view grad school as like an opportunity to go deep in a topic. And I know, again, just personally, hands-on learning and training is, I think, one of the best ways to go deep, because most people learn by experience. And so I don't think that having like grades is the best way to ascertain like if someone is proficient in a topic. And I was talking to actually someone the other day about this, of like how I was approaching school in undergrad and even a little bit in grad school versus like I audited some courses as a postdoc, and just like my mindset was completely different when it was like, there's no grade associated with this. And like, I just want to do this because I need to learn this topic, or not even I need to, like, I want to learn this topic. Like, I'm reaching out to you saying like, I want to sit in this class and learn this,
right?
Because I think it will be beneficial. So I remember like I was in this, like, what is it? Not the lecture, but the hands-on training
lab.
Yeah. Like a lab. And it was like a computer lab, because it was a systems biology course. And I couldn't get, or I didn't quite understand what was happening. And the TA like came over and I think he told me like, oh, you just need to do this. But he didn't really explain like the why and the reasoning behind it. And I remember thinking like, if I was an undergrad, or when I was an undergrad, I think that would have been sufficient for me, because I would have just been like, oh, this is what I need to like complete this task. And like, I would get an A and like, that's fine. But at the time it was like, I'm not here for a grade. I'm not here to just like pass. I actually am trying to understand and learn. So like, can you actually teach me like what, why, when, where, all of that behind like what we're actually doing. And so again, I do think that rethinking how we examine and grade people is one way that the field needs to probably change. And even again, going back to quals and like, is it sufficient to, like, I do think there needs to be some type of process where we see, like, is the student qualified or prepared to, like, go into or continue on in the program? But should it be, you know, an oral exam where they're just, like, bombarded with random questions that are either related or not related to the field? And like, is that really the best way to determine like if they can problem solve? People have different ways of learning and communicating. I know for me, sometimes if you tell me something, I need to go sit and like ruminate on it and like just marinate, and then I can come up with like my best things. Like if you want me to give you a response, like my best response in 2 minutes,
It's not happening,
right? So like, is that really the best way? And I know there's written quals, but I think some of these things could be relooked at.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like they're formed on a standard that doesn't fit the population. Maybe it fits a few like minds. So that's a good point to make. Are there any misconceptions that you feel are applied to your research or your training?
So I don't know if it's in the field, but maybe broader, like public. I think, again, going back to the fact that your immune system can be harmful, that's not really a misconception, but I don't know if people always think about it that way.
Okay.
And so, and again, I think that's more of like the broader public. And so I think my research is trying to get at that idea of like, it's helpful. And even when people say inflammation, because I'm interested in like inflammatory responses, I think a lot of times that's also has like this negative connotation of like, oh, you don't want inflammation, but actually it's beneficial. And so actually trying to understand like, what are the limits, like how much inflammation is good? And again, what are some of those triggers that will make it harmful? So that's maybe one aspect, because I know for me, when I was thinking, like, again, usually if someone said inflammation, I was like, ooh, like, not good.
Right.
But in terms of the like modeling aspects, I don't know. I do think people, and I say people generally, I don't really know if this is what people think. I can just say like, this is was my thought or perception, but sometimes I do think there's this idea that if you have like this modeling, I think it goes two ways. Some people are like, ooh, the modeling is like really beneficial and it can answer a lot of questions. But I also think some people are like, what are you doing? This is like this random thing that isn't that beneficial. And so and that's why I'm more of a, again, a systems biologist who does both in this iterative process. I don't think that models can solve all problems. And I think you also need to ground it in truth, which is the actual experiments themselves.
Right.
But I also think that they are so helpful and can really bring about ideas or a hypothesis that you may not have thought about. And so I do think having both is beneficial, and one or the other, I think, you know, there's just more limitations.
I see. Have you, I always love to ask this question to faculty just out of curiosity, but have you mastered the art of how to explain your project to non-scientists, especially your friends and family?
Not at all. I feel like I'm still trying to work on my pitch, and I don't think my family really knows what I do. Like, they kind of know what I do.
Yeah.
But no, I think that's like an ongoing thing. And then your project always changes and evolves. And so, like, you know, you always have to think about new ways to describe what you're doing. I think at a high level, I can describe it with analogies. Like I have mentioned the analogy of like an intruder coming to your home.
Right.
But if I wanted to go like another layer deeper, if I have to start using certain terms, they'll probably get lost.
Yeah.
So I think it is hard to try to find a good balance of like, not to make it too, you know, elementary,
jargony.
But absolutely, not too jargony.
Okay. So let's pivot a little bit to a lighter note. And so we've got a Missouri woman in California. What have you found yourself doing now that you move out here outside of science?
So I would love to say I go to the beach all the time, but I feel like San Francisco beaches are not...
It's not made for pleasure.
It's way too cold.
No.
So I do like the parks in San Francisco.
Okay.
And so I'm usually trying to... Well, not as much lately, but especially when I first came here, I was like walking to various parks. Like they are... Some of them are larger parks. Like there's the Golden Gate Park, which is, you know, expansive.
Right.
But then San Francisco also has these like cute, quaint parks that you'll just be walking and you're just like, oh, like I didn't know this was here.
Yeah.
Like, and then being in a city with so much green space, I think is really helpful because I just love nature. So that San Francisco is known for its food. I haven't gone to as many restaurants since I've been here, but I do enjoy just like the different cultures and types of food that you can get here. I live near Japantown, so that's always fun.
Okay.
Actually, earlier this week, I was like, I just want some ramen. And so, like, just being able to, like, grab some ramen
right.
when I want, or, you know, dumplings, or just various cuisines.
Mission always has plenty of variety of food on top of dumplings and ramen. So if you're looking for more diverse options, Mission is always a go-to.
See, I go to the Mission, but not for a lot of food. Like my church is there, so I go there for that. And but yes, I should do more in the Mission. Yeah.
You mentioned church. I don't know if you're comfortable talking about this, but
Can you talk a little bit about how it's been maintaining your religion and your practices while moving out here as well?
Yeah, that wasn't hard.
I don't know if people like to talk about religion, but you don't hear that often, and especially in the city. Mm-hmm. And I found that a lot of the Black students that I interact with kind of struggle finding that church home, which is very different than when you're from the East Coast or Midwest, where you know your church home. So out here, I find that it's a little different. The culture of church is different.
Yes.
How's that been for you?
Well, I lived in LA for some time, so I guess, you know, it wasn't like I came straight from the Midwest here. But I do feel like finding a church is like dating. It takes time, and you actually do have to put a lot of effort. So when I first got here, and again, this isn't my first rodeo in terms of going to a new city. So like, I already knew, like, you need to put a lot of energy at the beginning of like, let me check out these different churches and let me ask friends who like are from the area. Like, do you have recommendations on places that you would recommend that you think are solid? And so luckily, you know, I got recommendations and I checked them out and I was able to find something that I enjoyed, and I thought that I related to their principles, I guess, for lack of a better term. And so I don't think it was hard in terms of like there were options. I think it was hard in terms of like it takes work. But I think anything that's worth having is going to take some time and effort. And so you just have to be willing to put in that effort. So I'm definitely happy that I found something, because it's like work can be overwhelming. And so just having something outside of work that's like centering and allows you to like think of yourself in a broader context, like, you know, as much as I think it's hard not to be selfish as humans. And so to remind yourself that like there's things beyond what you're doing in at UCSF that are important and that matter, I think is important for me.
And it sounds like a lot of what I hear from the faculty is community. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of community in these different locations, whether that be, you know, a religious place or UCSF or off campus somewhere else. Like, I think community seems to be one of the most important factors universally. Mm-hmm. When finding a community, what do you look for? Or do you just kind of go to the community that's more welcoming to you? Or do you look for a specific values that you share?
What I look for is people who actually also want to be a part of a community and, like, again, will put effort into building relationships with people. Like, and it's interesting because this actually got brought up at church this past Sunday, of like this idea that people feel like they like don't have a purpose, but it's really that they are wandering too much and they won't actually just be rooted and take time to actually invest in something that allows them to like see that purpose and like fulfill that purpose. And so I think even when looking for a community, it's like who or what group of people, again, care about me or other people in terms of like a whole self, and then are they willing to put in work and effort to actually build relationships with other people?
I see. Okay. Is there anything else that you want our audience to know about the Dr. Katera Wilder? Anything that we didn't get to discuss in this interview that you would like people to know about you or about your journey or about your project?
I know. I feel like we've hit a lot of topics. I don't know if there's much more. I will just say that Kansas City is an amazing place.
Okay.
I feel like
great barbecue.
A lot of people, especially on the West Coast or either coast, I feel like they know little about the Midwest. And so, you know, this is lighthearted, but still, like, if there's anything more, it's like the Midwest is important. The middle of the country also has value.
Yeah.
People should go to Kansas City, try some barbecue, explore. Actually, NSBE, I don't know if you're going to NSBE, the National Society of Black Engineers. I guess you're not an engineer, so you wouldn't go. But
yeah,
National Society of Black Engineers, that's happening this year in Kansas City. So
okay.
I'm excited that there's like investment into, you know, some of these smaller cities that are, again, are important for just our nation.
Are you attending?
I am attending, so I'm also excited to like go and try to recruit more Black engineers that are young to hopefully come to UCSF, and hopefully we'll be able to increase the numbers here.
I look forward to a barbecue plate if you can smuggle one on the airplane.
I probably could smuggle one, but I'll probably eat it. I don't know if they'll make it to you.
That's fair. That's fair. Well, we appreciate you for joining us in this interview. I feel like we hit a lot of important but great topics to discuss. And so, you know, we look forward to working with you in the future. And BSTEM, of course, looks forward to working with you in the future.
Agreed. Thank you so much for this. And I'm so excited to, again, be here and to work with BSTEM and just also work with you.
Thank you.
So thanks for having me.
All right.
Thank you to Keturah Wilder for a phenomenal interview. You can stay up to date with her lab on Twitter at Wilder_lab. This episode was produced by Sydney Williams, Camila Benitez, and Maggie Colton, with help from the rest of the team at CTOR in collaboration with BSTEM. If you want to learn more about BSTEM and get connected with us, feel free to follow us on Instagram at BSTEM_UCSF, or you can follow us on the website at ucsf.campusgroups.com/BSTEM. Music for this episode was written by Landsman Duets, and a big thank you to our Patreon supporters, Ann Colton, Mark Kunitomi, Catherine Batchelor, Carly Van Orsdale, Merrill Horn, Levy Kai, Stephanie Redman, Paul Breslin, Karuna Mehta, and Colombo Ahmed. If you'd like to support the show, just $1 an episode goes a long way. If you like this episode and want to hear more, you can find Carry the One Radio on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, or head to our website at carrytheoneradio.com for more information. Thanks for listening, and stay curious.